Hello, and welcome to our podcast, In the Same Vein, coming from the Department of Health Humanities and Bioethics at the University of Rochester Medical Center. I'm Dr. Christy Slobogan.
And I'm Isabella Cantor.
And today we are talking to Dr. Danielle Ofri. And do you want to tell us who she is and who you are?
Sure. So I am a second-year medical student at the University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry. And we had the pleasure of talking to Dr. Ofri. Dr. Danielle Ofri is an MD-PhD, and she's a primary care internist at Bellevue Hospital in New York City and a clinical professor of medicine at NYU. She writes about medicine and the doctor-patient connection. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times, the New Yorker, and the Atlantic, as well as the Lancet and the New England Journal of Medicine. Some of her books have included Singular Intimacies, Becoming a Doctor at Bellevue, What Patients Say, What Doctors Hear, What Doctors Feel, How Emotions Affect the Practice of Medicine, and most recently, When We Do Harm, A Doctor Confronts Medical Error.
So in today's episode, we mostly talked to Dr. Ofri about her most recent book, When We Do Harm, all about medical error. But in the process of asking her about medical error, we end up talking a lot about emotions in medicine. We end up talking about the role of art and literature and taking care of yourself as a doctor, as part of medical practice. And we also talked a lot about medical education. So we cover a lot of topics here, but it's a really, really wonderful conversation with Dr. Ofri. So without further ado, we will get straight to the interview.
Dr. Ofri, I've been reading your books and articles since I was, I guess, in high school. Your New York Times articles, my mom would always cut them out for me. But this particular book, after college, I worked in a primary care practice in North Carolina, and I was a medical assistant for 2 years. And during these 2 years, I had an error myself. I was starting to get really good at my job. I was, you know, I had that flow going. Then I made a vaccine error. And my reaction to it immediately was, of course, the crippling shame and guilt and the horror of the mistake. You know, my coworkers were very kind. You know, they talked to me. But I did have to go back to work the next day. And I realized, okay, so, you know, if I'm going to continue in the medical field, I have to figure out how to react to errors when they occur, because I realized, you know, all my coworkers had told me about their experiences with error. And so clearly I was not the only one, and I had to figure out how to get past it. So I decided that I needed to turn to reading about other people's experiences. So I looked it up, and sure enough, you had a book written about it. Just, I think it was 2 years earlier, maybe 1 year earlier. So it was really perfect timing that I found When We Do Harm. And I had to take a couple of weeks to start reading it. But then when I did, I felt a whole lot more comforted and just, you know, feeling like I was part of a community that these things happened to rather than an individual who made a mistake. And, you know, this was my way of keeping going on the path to medical school and beyond. So, yeah, your book meant a lot to me during those 2 years. And so I'm just so excited to talk to you about it.
When you write, you know, you never know when you scribble stuff on a page, because you're writing, you know, in your little room, how it'll affect anyone, if at all. You send it out and that's it. You often never hear back from anyone. So it's really nice to hear that.
So we'll mostly be asking about and talking about your book, When We Do Harm, about medical error, but we'll also likely dip into some of the ideas in your other books. So to get us started, could you explain to our listeners what medical error is? And I know, you know, it's a difficult thing to define, but if you could tell us what led you to investigate this phenomenon?
Yeah, well, it actually is pretty hard to define. I'll say there are many definitions. I mean, I think we know some of them when we see them. You know, you pick up the wrong syringe, inject the wrong medication, or amputate the wrong leg. We know that's an error. But I think that increasingly people are thinking more broadly about patient harm. So if you give or do the wrong thing, even if it was unintentional, or even if it was the right thing, but the patient had a bad experience. You sent a patient for a CAT scan with contrast and put them into renal failure. Well, that's a really bad outcome. Whether or not it was a mistake, it was still a really harmful thing for the patient. And for the patient, it doesn't necessarily matter if it was a mistake or not. They're still suffering the effects. So we can think about, again, error, what we do, but patient harm, what patients experience. And how I got to this topic, beside making many errors and mistakes myself along the way, is that in the spring of, I guess, 2016, my editor emailed me an article she read in the Boston Globe, which my editors and publishers often do, because when you're the only physician in a publishing house full of English majors, you get all their medical questions. And so she saw this article that said that medical error was the third leading cause of death. And she was like, is this true? I thought, you know, I don't know if it's true, to be honest. And I felt a little weird not knowing the answer, because obviously if it was the third leading cause of death, you know, after heart disease and cancer, I should be seeing it every day, right? I'm in a busy medical clinic in a big city hospital in the biggest city in the country. And I wasn't seeing medical error every day, or I certainly didn't think I was seeing it. So then I wondered, well, either I have blinders on and I'm, you know, part of the problem is that we're all a little bit blinded to errors, or maybe it wasn't true. And so I thought, you know, this is a great thing to investigate. And that's kind of how the book started.
That's great. Thank you so much.
So there are many personal stories of patients and families dealing with medical error throughout the book, and we're interested in learning more about your methods. They are somewhat anthropological and seem to be interview-based. So how did you find these people to talk to, and what's your approach with them, and how did you build their trust?
It varied a lot. So some stories, as you'll know, are my own stories or stories I've heard from friends and colleagues. So when I start a book like this and I'm looking for stories, I mean, let me just back up and say that it's very hard for me to start this kind of book without a narrative arc. So my first couple of books were all just stories of things that happened. And it took me a couple of books in to start to write about a topic. But even with a topic, I needed a narrative spine. And so I spent a lot of time till I found the story of Jay that became the narrative spine for this book. And for my previous book, the story of Morgan Amanda. And so one thing is I sent an email out to all my friends and colleagues, hey, I'm writing this book. This is what I'm interested in. If you know anything or had an experience or know anyone, I posted on social media, some patient safety groups, and then eventually this one person wrote back to me amongst many. I interview many people, and with the story of Jay and interviewing his wife, Tara, I really felt like I found the story that could take us into the issue in a human way. And what appealed to me about the story in particular was that Tara herself was a nurse. So here was someone who understood how the medical profession worked. And I think that was an interesting thing because there's often a huge gap between lay people and medical professionals. So I thought that was an interesting lens. And then we did interviews, multiple interviews over the course of a year. So we spoke on the phone, we did Zoom calls, we met in person once or twice, we wrote emails back and forth. So it was just a lot of stuff. And you're right, it takes a long time to build trust. And I would say it's not so different than with your patient when you're a physician. So one is being honest about why you're doing this and what you're doing it for, to give them a role in the driver's seat. You know, you tell me whatever you feel comfortable sharing, and then there's nothing I'm going to publish without showing it to you first. And you can decide what you do or don't want out there, what names you want to use, your real name, a pseudonym, your first name, initial, last name, you know, whatever you would like. And so it was very careful. And I had, for all people who were profiled in the book, I had them all read, you know, what I'd written and then give me approval, both for the facts, but importantly for the emotional tone. I wanted to make sure that I captured what it felt like. I didn't want to be glib or something was genuine. I didn't want, you know, I wanted to make sure we hit the right emotional note. And that's really important to me because I think that people, when you write about them, they want to be respected. And getting the tone right is really key to that. And so I specifically would ask them how it sounds and feels to them. And if they were to read it, or family members, would they feel okay with how it comes across?
Yeah, that's so important. And I think I think, Bella, you would agree with me that it does feel like a lot of care is taken with these stories, and you can read that in the tone throughout. Obviously, you know, we know Jay's story, but for our listeners, could you just give a little bit more about that narrative arc and that story that kind of serves as the backbone of the book?
To be brief, so Jay is a young aviator, and he's, I guess, in his mid-40s, and he and his wife have two school-aged children, and he's completely healthy. You know, he serves in the Naval Reserve, so he's very fit, and he doesn't feel so well. And within weeks, this spirals to really an acute leukemia, which, if you have any familiarity with acute leukemia, people get very sick very fast, and there are many, many moving parts. Their cell counts drop, they're prone to infections, they have bleeding, there's treating. It's very, very aggressive, can be a very aggressive illness. And there were complications along the way. So I profiled the story through his wife, Tara, who's a nurse. And as I mentioned, that was really an interesting way to do that, because so often when there's an error or bad outcome, let's say, there's a big gap in understanding. And patients often have an expectation that might be unrealistic of what medicine's able to do. Like, why isn't my spouse, parent, you know, cured? Why aren't they healed? Why isn't their pain completely gone? And they don't recognize the amount of uncertainty, ambiguity that takes place on the back end of medicine, and how complicated things can be. So with a nurse who understood that whole element of kind of an imbalance of understanding, that was erased. Then we could take just from there how the errors happened. And of course, the errors boil a lot down to communication. And it's sort of funny because the book before that was a book on communication, what patients say, what doctors hear. And in some ways, I almost felt like I was writing the book again, because so many medical errors or bad outcomes come down to communication. Certainly in Jay's case, there was a lot of communication, and there was also a lot of bad luck and just terrible pathology that led to bad outcomes.
Yeah. So just to talk a little bit more about Jay's story, both times that I read it, I cried. I just sobbed. And I was wondering, how do you cope with the strong emotions in medicine? And I know you wrote a whole book on it. It's called How Doctors Feel. But how do you transmit this ability to feel and cope to your trainees? And then finally, I know a lot of questions in here, sorry. But when do you find yourself thinking about patients like Jay, about that little cemetery that you bring up in the end of your book that each physician carries with them?
So that is a big question. So maybe I'll break it up. So I'll start with how about in writing, because it is very emotional. And it's funny, I don't often feel that emotion while I'm writing it, but then I'll read it back and I get the choke up too. And then I realize this is how intense this is when I'm writing. It's almost, you know, when you start medical school, maybe you do your first dissection in anatomy, you kind of block it out because you're so involved in the mechanics of it. But then you step away and realize that this is a human being who has died that you're cutting open. And I have the same feeling when I'm writing. Not that I'm not feeling the emotion, but I'm so intent on the mechanics and the logistics and the craft of writing that it gets pushed aside a little bit until I read it back. Or someone else reads and tells me that they cried. I wrote about when our family dog died. And for my kids, who were teenagers at the time, this was the first and only death they'd ever faced in their life. And it was very devastating. And every so often, when they want to remember Juliet, they'll look it up in the New York Times and read it. And they'll burst out crying and they'll get angry at me. How could you write that and make me cry every single time? So there's, you know, you don't know if you've conveyed the emotion until you get other people's reaction. Now, in medical practice, that comes up a lot too. And, you know, speaking of the cemetery, so a long-term patient of mine just passed away 2 weeks ago. And quite suddenly, I wasn't expecting it, although she certainly had potential for difficult medical issues, I wasn't expecting it. And it really caught me unawares. And when I'm not prepared, then the emotion is really strong, as opposed to patients who I know are dying. And I guess I'm girding myself as we go along. And my advice to trainees and colleagues is that it is important to feel that. I mean, if we didn't feel sad when our patients died, then we're missing something. And as I try to tell my children when they cry anew each time they read about losing their dog, you know, grief is the flip side to love. You know, if we love someone, you know, then we grieve over them. And if we don't grieve, then we didn't have the gift of love. And so the fact that they cry every single time reminds us of how important that relationship was. We are so, I think, fortunate as physicians to be intimate with our patients in their lives, in their difficult moments, sometimes for years. And so, of course, it makes sense we'll feel sad and we'll cry. And so to allow that emotion to really flow, it's honest and real. And if we don't let it flow, then we're just going to give ourselves and our patients problems going forward. Now, there is a situation for physicians that might be different from other professions, that there are moments when the emotion flowing might not be appropriate. And I think here we have to distinguish how we might be with our family members versus our patients. And for our patients, their well-being comes first before ours. And so if our emotion and grief overwhelms them or takes center stage or gets in any way makes it harder for our patients or their family members, then we have to be able to put that aside, which I will say temporarily, we still have to give it its due, but to recognize that there are moments when we need to give precedence to someone else's emotions and take what can be a difficult step to sort of hold ours back or allow the amount forward that feels helpful. And of course, that's subjective. I recognize that. But to recognize, you know, when it might be too much and, you know, swallow that back a little bit, but then you give it time if it's on the weekend or in the evening or, you know, with your own partners and friends, because it always needs to get its due at some point. And it's part of the training to sort of get the sense of when it's the right time and when it needs to hold off for a little bit.
That's a great answer. Thank you so much. So obviously, one of the purposes of books like this, books that you write, is to dig into that emotion and kind of reveal it in a way. But I was wondering if you could speak to what else you're trying to achieve with the books that you write, in particular, When We Do Harm. What do you see to be the main roles of books like these that are accessible, oftentimes heartbreaking, but on a very particular topic and, you know, involving a lot of research? What do you hope to achieve with these types of books?
You know, my primary interest has always been storytelling, which is why my first books, as I said, were all more just stories. But as I've moved along in my writing career, I feel that I'd come across these topics that seem like we're all have a lot of confusion and lack of clarity, partly because these topics are not straightforward. Medical error, communication, emotions, they're not easy topics and they'll never be fully explicated. But that's what makes them an interesting topic to tackle. And what I'm hoping for is to write in a way that can both speak to medical professionals, but also speak to the general public without talking down to anyone, being condescending, or being too simplistic. And that can sometimes be a tough needle to thread. But I want to help the public understand how medicine works. There's so much that we know intuitively, culturally in medicine that I think patients are not aware of. And so understanding kind of what's behind the curtain is very helpful. But I also think that for many medical professionals, we don't often look behind our own curtain. So I think, or I hope it can be achieved together by writing them together, but the basis is a story, because that's the most interesting thing. I mean, if you ever go to Grand Rounds and the speaker is showing, you know, 50 or 100 slides of Western blots and, you know, mortality curves, and, you know, you see people dozing and they say, oh, I once had this patient, and everyone wakes up because now there's going to be a story, and we're just wired to be riveted by stories of character and plot and challenge. And it's just the way we're wired to hear things. And me too, I find stories the most interesting. And so finding the stories to tell this and then kind of reach out to the research as opposed to starting, okay, let me just list the 10 things I've got to accomplish about medical error, get all the research for that, you know, and throw it out there. That doesn't interest me. And then there are other books that do that and do it well. It's not the kind of book that I'll either read or write.
There are so many layers to what you're doing. And even on the more practical side of things, you know, you're saying you're not listing things out, but as I was finishing your book, my husband was in the same room and I was like, if one of us is a patient in this kind of context, like this is what we have to both be thinking about, write it down, you know? So it was a very practical, logistical end to the book that I found really, yeah, really great and really, really helpful in addition to all the stories that helped to make it real.
I guess because I don't want it to be a self-help book.
Right.
So there are those two that just give you the top 10 tips to do things. And obviously you want to have some practical things, but I never remember those things.
Right.
So if I put it in a story, hopefully that illustrates it. Maybe it's easier to remember.
And I don't think I would have paid as much attention to those, as you say, like self-help things, if there hadn't been those really strong stories like Jay's throughout the book. So yeah, I thought that was great.
Yeah. And similarly, I was to the ability to find the connection to your own life. I was in the hospital with my dad when I was finishing reading your book, and I was acutely aware of being caught between these two worlds. And I just didn't want to tell people that I was a medical student, because I didn't want, you know, I don't know anything. I was a first year medical student and I didn't want to tread on anybody's toes. But it was interesting, you know, with the context of your book, just trying to navigate those different roles. And so I guess I'm curious about how you've navigated those roles yourself, and also how your colleagues have reacted to you talking about medical error, which is a topic that is in some ways pretty hush-hush, and then in other ways, you know, like the morbidity and mortality conferences, not as hush-hush, but, you know, how do you navigate that?
Well, starting with your last question first, I think for topics like that, I would say most people are relieved that we write about it. I mean, there are topics that can tick some people off, you know, an op-ed on the obscene profits of nonprofit hospitals. You know, some people were not thrilled, you know, in different positions in the hospital to read that type of thing. But I'd say because it's so universal that we've all made errors, I think people were relieved, especially because I tried to take pains not to be accusatory. You know, there are definitely forums out there that, you know, no matter what you write, it's those money-grubbing doctors or, you know, will do anything and they don't care about you. And I think that, you know, at this point in my career now, you've probably noticed this too, that almost everyone who goes into medicine or nursing or healthcare in general, they basically want to do the right thing for their patients. I don't think anyone goes into these fields any longer for the money and the prestige. I mean, there's much easier ways to make a great salary and not, you know, get puked on your shoes and things like that, or stay up all night. So I think people who are in it genuinely want to do the right thing. I mean, are there a few bad apples? Yeah, sure. That means humanity. But by and large, people aren't out there to take advantage of their patients. And yet, of course, errors still happen. And so that's really the tension that I think most people feel. They want to do the right thing, and yet something bad happens to their patient. Even if it was inadvertent, we still take it so much to heart. So I found that most medical professionals were relieved to see this type of thing in writing, things that they've been feeling but haven't talked about. That's more the reaction that I've gotten.
That's great. Thank you. Kind of staying on this reaction side of medical error, we found it really interesting that you use the word horror to describe your reaction to committing a medical error. And I mean, Bella, I noticed that you used that word at the very beginning of this recording too, talking about your own personal experience. And it's such a distinct word. And both of us, as we were reading it together, we flagged that. And so we wanted to ask, I mean, this is a very granular question, but what does that word mean to you? And why do you think that it applies so well to the emotions that one feels in these situations with medical error?
Well, it's hard to imagine anything worse than harming someone in your care, be it your child, your pet, or your patient. And I think when someone's entrusted to your care, you take that seriously, and you're trying your best to keep them as well and to get the best outcome. So for them to have something bad happen, I can't think of a more appropriate word. It is the most horrific and horrible thing. And it is a horror that this happened to someone that I'm caring for. Just remembering when one of my children had an accident or something on my watch, or my pet, or my patient, there's just nothing worse than that. And again, because most people, I think, in healthcare are there to do the right thing, you know, if we didn't care, then it wouldn't be a big deal. But I think most everyone really does care. And it's so the antithesis of what you think you're doing with your life that it comes across as a horror.
So you say in your book that, and this is a quote, "I suspect that time to think would also make a substantial dent in the demoralization of medical professionals today, but that's a whole other story." And that's on page 67. So we want to get into that story. And would you mind elaborating on that particular sentence for us?
Sure. So the context was that in trying to avoid medical error, I think that giving doctors and nurses more time to think and be less crowded and rushed in their thinking, I can't prove it, but I think we certainly know that when our brains are cluttered, we probably make more errors. But I also think that having more time to think would improve the demoralization. And I think that's on at least two grounds. So one is that we want to be giving our patients good care. And so we want to cross every T and dot every I, and not having time to do that, having to cut corners, you know, saps the soul of anyone who cares about what they're doing. Again, if you don't care, it doesn't matter. But if you care about doing a good job, then cutting corners doesn't just do poor care. It makes you feel like you're a worse nurse or doctor. And that is demoralizing. I don't ever want to cut corners when I'm doing something I care about. If I cut corners when I'm, you know, baking cookies, you know, so what? So the cookies don't come out well. But if I have to cut corners when I'm taking care of a complicated patient, for example, I had a new patient session, and you get the same amount of time for all the patients. And a lot of the new patients, you know, they come and they have one issue. It's plenty of time. But I had the, you know, occasional patient who comes in without that. And this is a patient who came in, family member of someone who brought them from their country here, just diagnosed with cancer, with heart failure and pulmonary hypertension and, you know, six or eight big things, a stack of records in another language. And I had the same amount of time. I thought, there's no way I can do a good job in the time allotted. For this kind of patient, I probably need 2 hours. I want to go through everything. I don't want to leave because I could miss something. And it felt terrible to be kind of rushing through. It was like a hospital admission, but it was a clinic visit. And that just, it feels awful. And you feel like you're being a bad doctor. And so I think that having extra time to do a good job, we all want to do a good job. So that's a big part of it. And then the second part of it is, I think what also attracts us to medicine and to healthcare is the community and relationship we have with the patient. And you need some time to develop that. And you want to learn about their background, who they are, what their home life is like, their situation, a sense of what they do. And I think it's not just to have fun, have a great relationship, but I think it also matters a lot clinically. But it also, when you talk earlier about building trust, getting to know someone and what their situation is so critical. And I can think of countless times that I've missed that when things have been rushed and it's been so critical. Like I had a patient, I think I mentioned him maybe in the last book, but a really sweet guy. And we were having a lot of trouble with medication adherence. And every time he came, I would make these gorgeous medication lists, write them all out and really clearly underline, highlight, and he'd come back and it was a mess again. And we went on this like this for a year. And then he told me, literally a year in, that he couldn't read. And I felt terrible. Here I am thinking, oh, this guy's just not adhering to his medication regimen, but he couldn't read. And I had not taken the time to do the background check to have known that. And had I known that, I could have been such a better doctor for him. But also, I would have saved him the humility of having to announce to me that he couldn't read. And so I'm much more careful now about, you know, seeing what people's educational background is in as non-threatening a way as possible. But it matters because I will come across patients who haven't gone beyond a low grade. And I need to know that. So when I give them their medical care, that I can be sensitive to that. So these are so important, I think, both to do a good job, to establish a relationship, and to feel like you're making this human connection of trust. And that just takes time. And when you're trying to do it in just a compressed amount of time, you end up missing out on that. So I do think both for medical errors and for, you know, for the burnout, it would help to have more time to do our job.
I mean, even just, you know, I'm not a clinician, I don't work in clinical spaces, but even just, or when I have too much on my plate or when I'm rushing, I'm way more prone to, you know, make the error of forgetting my wallet at home or forgetting my phone at home. So I can't even imagine, you know, having that same feeling in a clinical space and making similar errors that have impact on other people's lives and health as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So I know that you are a busy attending. And for our listeners who may not be familiar with medical hierarchy, you know, you have your medical student, intern, resident, fellow, and then eventually, you know, after many levels of training, you become an attending. And you are a busy attending. And I'm wondering if you can talk about and reflect on your own training and talk about if there's a particular year of training or an experience where you feel like this lack of time sort of started, or, you know, there were any changes to your level of empathy, loss or gain, and your ability to emotionally deal with some of the challenging aspects of medicine.
I mean, I think, and I'm not alone in this, but becoming an intern versus being a medical student, when you're kind of like, you don't really have any responsibilities. You can spend 3 hours talking with a patient and doing the most thorough physical exam and no one cares how long it takes, which is great. Suddenly you're an intern and things are just flying at you. You have to admit, you know, five patients, you have this long a Scott list, and you suddenly realize, you know, and I started internship as a night float. So I was just putting out fires all around the hospital. And no matter what I did, you know, you couldn't be everywhere. And that realization was just terrible. But I remember where I felt that emotional burn is a very distinct memory. So when I was an intern, a friend of mine, my age, had a sudden cardiac death. He had a congenital heart condition that was asymptomatic, and he just dropped dead on the street. And it was terrible. He was a long-term camp friend of mine. And the day of his funeral, that my resident said I could get out early, but I had to do one more test. I had to put in a femoral line. It's a big IV in the big vein in the kind of thigh groin area on this patient who had very end-stage AIDS, was not really conscious. And I was trying to get this in. It was just, I was alone with this big needle and I'm kind of jabbing it into his groin. And of course, you know, you've hit it when you suddenly get a syringe full of blood and you're just waiting for that blood. And I remember feeling this calculus of that the more time I'm with this patient of mine, the less time I'll have to be at the funeral of my dear friend. And it was like, it was one or the other. And I had to get this line. I couldn't. And I began to feel like this patient, this object, he was standing in the way of me going to this funeral. And I was so angry and I could feel myself getting vicious and just stabbing that in and sweating bullets. And I was completely alone. And I suddenly had like this vision of that his mother used to come and sit with him. And he couldn't talk at this point. And of course, he was far gone from the relationship, but she would come and sit with him anyway. And I suddenly remembered that he was once her little baby, this treasured, beautiful child, as was my friend to his parents who were now grieving, you know, at a funeral that I was trying to get to. And I remember stopping and because I felt like the anger and the not caring and just slamming the needle harder and harder. And I just began to cry. I really just began to cry. And I just called out for anyone to help me. And like a passing resident got my resident and we got the line in and I got out the door. But I realized that, A, I needed help, that I was not serving this patient well or serving me well. And that I was on the verge of developing something that I knew was terrible. And that's part of why I eventually took time off from academic medicine. You know, I was in my intern year then and I was sort of, you know, ready to just keep going. I'd been an MD, PhD, so I'd been in school already for what felt like forever. You know, I was going to be a chief resident and do a fellowship and specialize. And I realized that I needed to step away. Like the death and destruction was very intense. And, you know, there wasn't much sort of attention to how we were processing all this. And I heard about from a colleague who was doing locum tenens, which is temp work for doctors. I knew nothing about it. I thought, this is a great idea. I told my mentors and they said, it's a terrible idea. You'll forget all your medicine. You'll lose all your skills. You'll lose all your connections. You'll never get back into academic medicine. But then I spoke to a social worker, a therapist, and she said, oh, I think they're just jealous. I thought, you're right. And I'm out of here. And so when I finished residency, I signed up for, you know, locum tenens agency and just took off. And I worked like for 6 or 8 weeks in these basically small towns in America that were, you know, were short on doctors, rural New Mexico, rural Florida, New Hampshire. I worked for 6 or 8 weeks and then I would travel to South America till my money ran out. I'd call collect from Oaxaca, wherever I was, and I'd get the next gig. And it was in that year and a half that I started writing because I had all these stories from this intense training that were so close to the emotional bone that I couldn't write about them at the time. Of course, who had time anyway? And that's when I started writing just for a, not to write a book, but just as a place to put all these stories. They had to go somewhere. They couldn't just be this like ragged wound inside. I had to put them somewhere so that I could like take the next breath and go forward.
Thank you so much. And yeah, thank you for sharing that.
So thinking about how you made that transition and had that complicated set of emotions when you were on one hand, trying to make it to your friend's funeral, and on the other hand, trying to put an ephemeral line. And I would imagine that fear was also one of the emotions mixed in there. I mean, you definitely talk about fear in how doctors feel, your earlier book, and then also in this most recent book. And so I'm curious about how your fears about medicine have changed over time from training until now.
I mean, I think that fear never goes completely away, that we all have these moments. I think they get fewer as you move along because you now have been around the merry-go-round enough times that you've been in the place where you can't get a procedure done or can't figure out a diagnosis. And you start to realize that you can ask for help. There are people to help and that we are each other's keeper. And so when I call down the hallway for help and someone helped me, I now try to look out for other people who are in that moment. But, you know, that we have each other and that camaraderie is really important. And I think really felt it during COVID. You know, I think when so many people felt the sort of COVID, the quarantine, boredom and isolation, one thing we had in healthcare is we didn't have that. We had other things and fears, but at least we were all there together and we could be together, both with our fears, our nervousness, you know, and this project to build something out of nothing together. So relying on colleagues more and not thinking I have to do it all myself, but also being able to identify, oh, right now I'm feeling really scared. And once I can identify that, it's a little less frightening. And I think at the beginning, you feel, oh my God, I'm just a loser and a failure. I shouldn't be in medicine. I think that's our first reaction for all of this because we're all such perfectionists. So in that sense, it has gotten easier. And then also you get better at medicine. So it's, you know, something happens and you've seen this before. You've seen a patient get angry or a family member react in a difficult way. You've been there and you're more experienced in how to deal with it. And it's not so hard to do. So I would say it gets easier. It gets better with time. So don't worry.
No, I definitely appreciate that. And one of my reactions to when my own error happened was that I looked to the people who had been, as you say, around the merry-go-round a couple more times than I had. And, you know, speaking with mentors and the doctors at the clinic, that was really helpful for me. So I was wondering, in your view, how can instructors in medical schools help to start their students thinking about medical error critically from the beginning? And have you seen this instituted in a particularly positive way at any institution?
Well, I think for both medical errors, as well as emotions, communications, all of these things, is it really, you know, comes from the top. And so when I meet a new team, beside we introduce ourselves, blah, blah, where we're from, yada, yada, I rattle off five of my biggest medical errors just off the top. Here's what I have screwed up, you know, in my life, because you will too. And so when it happens, not if, but when, you know, we expect these things to happen. We're human beings. And so you can come to me and we'll handle this together. I don't remember any attending ever saying that to me. So when I had my error, my first reaction was to clam up. I can't admit to that because I'm going to get thrown out of the program. I'm going to get a bad, you know, write up, you know, all these terrible things came to mind. So I think setting the example and then demonstrating, you know, how we communicate in the face of a bad outcome, how we deal with difficult emotions. For example, so I see a patient, you know, losing it in the waiting room. You know, it happens periodically. Instead of like calling security, I always say, you know what, why don't we take care of it? And I'll try to bring my medical student intern with, let's go and see how we handle a patient who's really frustrated and angry. And model those skills, you know, in real time, as opposed to just like reflexively, you know, bringing down the hammer or whatever the situation is. So have I seen it instituted on a big scale? You know, it's hard to know because this is a really individual one-on-one kind of thing. It's not the kind of skills you can teach very well in PowerPoints or modules or the way we typically teach. I think that you have to see it in action. So I think that, and cycling back to having enough time to teach and show, how do we break a difficult diagnosis? How do we talk to patients about, you know, hospice and end of life care and things like that? How do we talk about a bad outcome? How do we talk about someone's difficult emotions? How do we talk about when a patient said a nasty thing to a medical student? Happens all the time. We have to do that. And so having enough time for more senior physicians to go with the team and talk about it, you know, and have the hour to deal with that. I think that's the kind of education. And, you know, I hear about it happening in different you know, with different people, but I can't, it's hard to measure on an institutional scale. I hope it is happening, but that's really the only way that I can see as for dealing with these things.
I love that you said that, because so many of these things that you're talking about as important for, not only for understanding medical error, but as being important for integration into medical education in general, is so much of what my department, our department, the department that this podcast is coming out of, Health Humanities and Bioethics, it's so much of what we're trying to do, you know, trying to teach things that aren't necessarily on a slide deck in that manner. You know, how do you deal with these emotions? How do you learn how to communicate in this way? How can we think of not only our patients as full humans, but also ourselves as full humans? So you're really speaking the language of, you know, our Health Humanities department and what kind of this podcast is trying to get to the heart of.
I mean, I'll also add that one thing is moving along as an attending in my training is recognizing the role of having passions and interests outside of medicine that are complementary. And I think as a medical student or an intern, you can't imagine having time or even like that you should even give 5 minutes of your attention away from being the New England Journal of Medicine to playing your flute or whatever it is that you do. We think that that's you know, sacrilege. But recognizing that, you know, whether it's literature, music, art, you know, or sport, something that you can let your passions and emotions work through is critically important, both as a healthcare provider, someone who, you know, gives healthcare, but also to yourself as a human being.
Yeah, and that brings me to, I really wanted to talk to you about your cello playing. I know that you play the cello, and I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about that.
Sure. So I played cello for about 2 months in third grade and then quit because the big kids used to trip me on the bus with the cello and I never touched it again. But fast forward a number of decades and my daughter, who was going to start kindergarten, where they had a violin program. And so I thought, oh, wouldn't it be great to give her lessons a year in advance? Like, wouldn't we be great parents? And so we signed her up for violin lessons and I asked the teacher, well, how do you get, you know, a kid to practice, particularly a stubborn kid. And I was thinking she's going to say, oh, sticker charts or ice cream. And she said, no, seeing a parent practice. I thought, oh, all right. So I thought I'll get the instrument next door. So I went out and bought the cheapest cello I could find, took lessons. And I totally fell in love. She eventually quit violin, but I was completely smitten. And I've been doing it ever since. And I actually just last month went to my first cello workshop for a week, which was just mind-blowing. I've never had the chance to spend a solid week doing my hobby. It's always been this thing I do on the side. And so just to play every day, all day, and focus on a piece and work with a pianist and working on the Brahms F major sonata, it's very intense. And it was so nice to have that be the only thing on your mind, tune out the news. So it was really wonderful. And so I try to play almost every night if I can. And it's great to, because the focus is constitutionally opposite of life in the hospital. You know, life in the hospital is like this frenetic frenzy of phones ringing and pagers and messages, and you're just constantly pulled in 1,000 directions at once. When you play music, you're like focusing, you know, on a single line or a single measure or even just a single note. And then, like with a string instrument, the note doesn't just have to be right, which of course is hard to do, but it also has to be beautiful. And beauty is something that doesn't get a lot of shrift in medicine, but, you know, there is a beauty to what we do, even though parts of it are distinctly unbeautiful. But the sort of wonder of an amazement at being part of people's lives, there's a beauty in that. And we get to be part of that. And so having, you know, another way to sort of celebrate beauty, even if you can't quite get the note to sound like Yo-Yo Ma, but you can try. Nothing wrong. Who says you can't try to be like Jacqueline Dupre? It also separately is a way to keep growing, because when you're in medical school and residency, you're on the uphill, you know, slope of medical knowledge, but it does kind of plateau, you know, midway in attendinghood. You know, there's new things that come on the scene, but, you know, hypertension is still hypertension. It doesn't change radically. And so you're not being stimulated in the same way. But music, you know, it's infinite, right? I'm never hitting a plateau because then my teacher's always giving me the next piece to do. And so I'm always like, the water's always up to my chin. And so it keeps you striving and moving. And that is just intellectually exciting. And so I think it just keeps me happy.
Well, and I think that is so important, as you were saying. And, you know, you play violin, right?
Yeah, I do play violin. And I made a commitment to stay, to keep on playing while I was in medical school. And I got through the first year. So I still play in a community orchestra with a lot of retired medical school professors. So it feels like a wonderful way to continue doing things that I love.
One of the things I hadn't planned on doing in my life when I was an MD, PhD, thinking I'd go into basic science, which I still love, but we ended up starting a literary journal, Bellevue Literary Review, which publishes fiction, poetry, and nonfiction about health, illness, and healing. And now we're more than 20 years on, you know, editing literature. But recently, we've been having contemporary artists on the cover. And so we've been doing studio visits. So I get to go to the artist studios and film a documentary about the artistic process for this particular artist. And so I just came back from interviewing the artist of the upcoming cover. And it's so much fun to get into someone else's head and their creative process. That's so different than medicine, so different than music. And being able to, you know, focus on poetry. We're having an event where a dance poetry event, where we take four poems from the journal, give it to four dancers, have them create an original dance to that, and then create a film short out of that. And so we're screening that next month. It's just very exciting to see how many ways there are to think about, you know, the issues that we grapple with. You know, for this dance poetry film, the theme is body politic, the intersection of our bodies and society. We've done disability, we've done recovery, and I just feel like you gain so much nuance by trying out different art forms that can contribute a little bit to your understanding, both intellectually and emotionally.
That all sounds amazing. It sounds so... Yeah, right up my street.
Yeah, so now we would just like to know, what's next for you? Do you have any big topics in medicine that you want to tackle?
Yeah, so I've started a new book, and it's about end of life and death and how we grapple with our fear of death, both as patients, but also as clinicians. And I think a lot of the reasons that we as clinicians don't do such a great job helping our patients face death is that we're scared shitless too. And so our own existential fears get in the way. So I'm thinking about that. So I'm also, you know, casting about for stories, interviewing people, kind of feeling where the book will go. And what I foresee going on is that I'm going to find the stories first, and then I'm going to hang the book around the stories, because they'll kind of lead me to what would be the emotional truth that I can come up with, or at least hope to, you know, illuminate a little bit. But that's what I'm thinking a lot about, end of life and death and how we die.
That sounds really wonderful. And again, you know, that ties to so many of the things that we've already talked about in this interview, you know, the importance of storytelling, emotions in medicine, all of that. So we can't wait to read it.
Give me a couple years.
Yeah. We'll do a follow-up interview in a couple of years. You'll come back.
Right, exactly.
After med school. But yeah, I guess that's really all the questions that we have for you. I mean, there's so much more that we could talk about, but I just want to say thank you for chatting with us.
You're very welcome. It was my pleasure. And I'll send you links to our upcoming events.